corte dedo. Good afternoon, welcome to a new episode of Journey Through Hell with Mental Health Conditions, El Infierno de las Enfermedades Mentales. We'd like to remind you, as we always do, that you can listen to this podcast on Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, and YouTube. Also, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Please share this podcast with your friends and help us raise awareness and fight against the stigma around mental illnesses. We never know if someone close to us might be suffering from a mental condition, such as depression, insomnia, schizophrenia. Remember that if anyone is interested in participating in one of these episodes and sharing their experiences, whether as a therapist, doctor, advocate, or patient, they can contact me at my email, tarcory@pm.me. Or they can contact me through the social networks that I already mentioned. Well, today we have a special guest for this episode who writes as a patient in mental health care. We have Mr. Bob Kisserman, who is the founding executive director of the Power of the Patient Project. Bob served as the program director of the Health Administration Program and was a member of the senior faculty at the Arcadia University School of Global Business for over 20 years. Throughout his 35-year career, Bob taught and mentored thousands of men and women, preparing them for careers in the healthcare system. Bob also practiced as a healthcare consultant and continues to work within the project as a consumer health librarian and medical sociologist. Bob was the CEO of one of the country's leading continuing medical education companies for over 15 years. Bob is the author of 4 books on medical practice management and over 200 articles on the issue of healthcare management and patient rights. Bob's passion is educating patients about their rights and empowering patients to be better consumers of the healthcare system in the U.S. Bob, thank you very much for being with us today. It's a pleasure to have you on our podcast. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that I didn't mention?
No. Thank you for the introduction. And it's a pleasure for me to be here.
Okay. Well, let's start with our conversation. And please let us know, what is the National Library of Patient Rights and Advocacy? How did it begin? And what do you have in mind to achieve with this project?
Well, as you mentioned, I am a retired professor of healthcare administration. In the last years of my working, I worked with several students who shared my interest in patient rights. And we created a project called the Power to the Patient Project. And it then evolved after I retired. We were then sanctioned by the National Library of Medicine, Bethesda, Maryland. And we became deemed the National Library of Patient Rights and Advocacy. We were established in 2014, and we have 2 components. We used to have 3. I'll explain that in a second. The first component is we have a very extensive digital library. Features over 300 videos with healthcare providers and healthcare professionals. They speak about all kinds of issues. They talk about mental health, women's health, men's health, patient rights. And so it's there for people to watch the videos. They're all on YouTube, and they're also on our website. Second part of our organization is that we have a research and publishing division. That's a relatively new part of our project. And what we do is we engage students, both undergraduate and graduate students from across the country, to be involved in research and then write books that we publish on a wide range of healthcare issues. We did have a magazine, a monthly online magazine called Today's Patient. This past summer, after 2 years of publishing, we decided not to continue it. So right now we are focusing on the digital library and the research and publishing division. Mission, as you said, is to empower and educate patients about their rights and to improve relationships that they have with their providers.
Bob, I have a couple of questions within this question. Does your organization receive funds from the government or any other sources?
We do not.
You do not. Okay. You mentioned that you have in your library recounts from providers.
Yes.
Mental health providers. What about from patients?
There are some videos that are from patients. They speak about their struggles. They speak about their journeys. So yes, thank you for mentioning that. There are many, many video segments that we have done with patients. Interestingly enough, we are headquartered in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania happens to be one of the meccas, if you will, of healthcare in the world. We have some of the finest hospitals and most brilliant physicians in the world focused in Philadelphia.
And so, in mental health conditions.
Sorry?
Or mental health conditions.
Mental health and physical health, yes.
Okay.
Spent several years creating these video segments with these doctors until COVID. When COVID came, we had to stop our filming, and then we resorted to Zoom. So about 75% of them are live, films live, and the other 25% are they're done by Zoom, and they're both very effective, very informative. And we have a whole section on mental health where we give resources, accurate resources for mental health. And also we have many interviews with mental health professionals.
Okay. If Pennsylvania is on top of other states in the country in terms of healthcare,
yes,
mental health care, do you agree with me that mental health care in the US is really poor?
Poor?
Yeah, it's kind of, it's not
very poor.
When we look at physical health, but I'm saying bad.
When we look at physical health next to mental health has taken a back seat, unfortunately. There's still a great stigma, as you well know and certainly have spoken about. There are groups, we have done research that shows us that there are many ethnic groups shy away from seeking mental health because of the stigma attached to it. I was very enthused when under the administration of President Clinton, they did change a law in the United States that made it mandatory for insurance companies to treat mental health in terms of reimbursement the way they do with physical health. However, I often have asked, and others have asked, is mental health treatment a right or a privilege in the United States? And some people would tell you it's a privilege because the mental health system in this country is very much based on pay for service. Insurance companies are very reluctant to pay for mental health services, as you know. So many people are left with the option of, if you cannot pay for it, you're going to have to seek out other ways of doing it. So perhaps later in the interview, we can talk about 12-step programs, which are grassroots programs that actually provide support, not only for people with addiction, but people with depression and with other mental illness issues.
Why don't we jump into that and you explain to us this 12-step program?
Sure. So when I was teaching, I always had a module or a unit on mental health. And I would start off that module, that lecture, with the fact that many of my students probably were not aware that there is a grassroots program called the 12-step program. And it was based on Alcoholics Anonymous and has grown to many other types of addictions and mental health issues. One of the most wonderful parts of it is that it's people who are in recovery, helping people who seek recovery. And very often this is the closest that some people are going to get, especially initially, to healthcare, to mental health support. The 12-step network is very, very strong. And I think that many times it will lead to therapy. There are many mental health outreach centers that support 12-step programs. So very often you're getting the benefit of working with people who have gone through what you're trying to go through and getting their support and their encouragement and their love. And at the same time, very often you find that the meetings are being held in places where there are competent mental health providers like licensed clinical social workers, psychologists, in many cases, nurse practitioners who can discuss medicine. And it doesn't cost anything. And that's the beautiful part of it. People can just walk into a room and feel that they are somewhere where people understand what they're going through.
Well, this sounds like a beautiful program. And we are talking about options and the information that patients can get to deal with their mental health conditions. And we are talking about how expensive it is in the US to get treatment.
Yes.
Do you have in your library options like, for instance, psilocybin for people to try?
Ask me that again, please.
Yeah, if in your library,
yes,
among the options that you offer,
yes,
to people, do you mention psilocybin treatment?
We do not.
You do not. Is there a reason for that? I know that is not FDA approved in the US.
Right. Now, actually, we have never done a segment on that. Interesting to learn more about it because I know very little about it.
Because there has been a lot of research in terms of the good effects of psilocybin and ayahuasca to treat depression and other mental health conditions.
Right.
And obviously the US government doesn't want to approve those treatments because it goes against the pharmaceutical companies.
Right.
They make a lot of money on medications. So I was just wondering if your project ever mentions something like that to patients.
We have not yet done that, but something to certainly explore.
Okay, all right. Okay, let me ask you this. Your publishing division has published four books in the past 6 months. Can you tell us about that collection and how they relate to patients' rights?
Sure. The first book that we, and again, these books have been, to a certain extent, under my leadership as a publisher, but they've been written collectively and collaboratively by a large team of very bright, very motivated students from across the country. We've done this remotely. All of these have been written since COVID. First one we did, which was last summer, called Reasonable Expectations, the Patient Side of Patient-Centered Care. And we looked at whether patients were really getting patient-centered care. The reason we researched that is because, especially here in the United States, we are plagued by a problem that's not new, but it has evolved over the last 10 years, let's say, of corporate medicine. Corporate medicine is where private companies, and in many cases, hospitals, take over the healthcare system. And the doctors work for them as employees. And because of that, sometimes they sacrifice patient care for the bottom line, financial bottom line. And we found, interestingly enough, that with mental health care, many people were very positive about working with their providers. However, they were very upset by the fact that in many cases, when they're working with providers and they had to pay them, that the session would end very abruptly after an hour or 45 minutes. And I don't know if the doctors, we've spoken with many psychiatrists and many psychologists. They feel that this is enough time to spend in a session. But unlike with physical health care, sometimes one needs to spend a little bit more time than the allotted time period to talk. So we explored how that could be changed, and we really focused on how the impression of the doctors, where they used to be able to spend as much time as they chose to, today, under the current system, they can't. Many of them are very frustrated to the point, as you're probably aware, that many of the older physicians have basically called it, they've retired, and or they've sold their practices to the big companies, and they, financially, they make out well, but they may go into other professions. We have a real crisis here in the United States because a lot of doctors are retiring, and they're retiring early, and we find that we're getting less and less men and women going into medicine. Physicians are burning out, getting to a point where there's a lot of physician burnout. And one of the things that I found very interesting is that many of the mental health practitioners told us that they feel that the very fact that they're dealing with mental health issues every single day, that burns them out tremendously. Many of them have expressed to me that there's a reason that many therapists go on vacation frequently because they need to recharge, perhaps more than other doctors who are treating primarily physical illness. So that's that first book. The second book was simply a compilation of the first year of our magazine. We called that the Hodgepodge of Health. Many different articles. There is a section on mental health. Some people who wrote of situations that they have had as patients. There's a lot of patient stories, especially in the area of mental health, in that book. The third book that we did this past summer, is called Protecting America and Exploring New Needs from Our Public Health System. It deals with the public health system and how that can be changed. And the most recent book is about exploring telemedicine, whether telemedicine since COVID has really improved access to care. One of the interesting things about mental health is that I believe, and many other people believe, that with telemedicine, it hasn't actually improved the access to care in mental health, because now people can, who had a stigma about going into a therapist, they can sit at their computer or their phone and they can talk to a therapist. As you're probably aware, there are many, many apps available to people where they can access qualified practitioners, providers, and ask questions and get answers and also go through therapy. In terms of telemedicine, I think telemedicine has done a great service to the mental health community, and because it works well and people don't have to come into an office. In many cases, the practitioners can spend more time with the patient. And interestingly enough, the book we are now working on that they just started, my group, is on mental health. We want to explore this whole concept of why there is so many boundaries and obstacles in terms of people getting help with mental illness. And that we hope will be published in December. Working on it right now.
Bob, aren't we missing there the patients' stories about this? Yes. And not just providing the provider's side of the story?
Yes.
I mean, at some point, are you going to have in your library or a book where patients are telling their story?
Yes, well like I said, in the Hodgepodge of Health book, where it was a compilation of our magazine, some of the authors actually have depression. Some of them have other issues that they openly discuss. So of all the four books that we've published over the last 2 years, that probably is the most revealing in terms of patient stories.
Okay.
We also have in our video library several segments of people discussing depression, OCD, schizophrenia, and some of the other, unfortunately, common diseases that people face. And so there are plenty of videos and reading that people can find in both our books and on our website. They can be, we actually have segregated them under the tab of mental health. So you can go to our website and actually tab mental health and see all these various videos and these patient stories in one section of our library.
Okay, you were talking about how your books relate to patients' rights.
Yes.
And that brings me to another question. What are some of the challenges you see in the way mental health care is practiced in the U.S. in terms of access to care and the relationship between therapists and patients and the patients' rights?
Right. So we mentioned already the cost of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Mentioned the fact that many therapists do not accept insurance.
Mm-hmm.
There is definitely discrimination in terms of who gets the help and how fast they get it. One of the things that I would like to sort of talk about briefly, this has disturbed me as long as I've known about it. You're probably aware, and your audience may be aware, that there's a concept that we have in medicine called the right of self-determination. The right of self-determination says that at a certain age, here in the United States, it's the age of 18, we have the right to make our own medical decisions. Up until the age of 18, the parent is responsible, parent or guardian is responsible for signing off on surgeries, and they take responsibility for the child. So that rule has been in effect for decades. One of the things I've always had a problem with and take exception with is that in mental health, that right of self-determination begins at 14 years old. So you have a young person coming into a therapy office, and they are allowed to basically say to the therapist, I don't want my parent to know what we talk about. I don't want
14 years old, did you say?
14 years old. And I've asked therapists, I've asked legislators, how can this be? You know, I've talked to many parents, and they say, this is very difficult. We're paying our bill to the therapist to treat our child. Yet the child has the right to basically tell the therapist that you can't share anything with my parents. Now, if the child says it's okay and signs a waiver, then there's no problem. But the child does have the right in this country to basically shut out anybody at the age of 14.
So basically, the provider can become both the therapist and the parent at the same time.
Yes. I mean, it deals with confidentiality. And child, and I will call them a child, usually it's a teenager at that point, they have the right to confidentiality of their records and of their discussions. The only thing, obviously, that the therapist is obligated to do if the child is going to talks about harming himself or herself or others, they're obligated, obviously, as a mandatory reporter to say something. But other than that, they are not obligated, therapists are not obligated to share the information with another person. And this becomes very difficult when the child is not doing well in school and the school wants to discuss something with the therapist, when the parent wants to discuss something with the therapist. This is unique to mental health and very, very disturbing.
Is that, I don't know if you know this, but I'm sure you do. Is this something that happens only in the US? Or is that something that happens in other, let's say, developed countries?
Carlos, I really don't know. But I do know that I have not heard of this being done in other countries. But I know that in the United States, it's been a law. And like I said, I've asked many people to explain it to me, and many people cannot. Just the way it is.
Aren't there studies, scientific studies, saying that at 14 years, a brain hasn't developed fully to make this kind of decision?
Exactly. Exactly.
So what is behind that to allow a 14-year-old kid to do something like this? I mean, there has to be something behind this.
I think that it probably we have, obviously, not only here in the United States, but throughout the world, crisis in terms of our teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Teenagers many times go unnoticed. Sometimes it's too late, and sadly, they take their lives. So I think that my understanding is that this law came about because many teens said, I will go to a therapist if I can guarantee myself that only the therapist and I have the discussion, that the therapist has some way of, I have some way as a patient not to have the information shared with anybody. Because the teenager will say, I will put my trust in the therapist, but at the same time, I don't want the therapist sharing what we talk about. Otherwise, I'll become inhibited about what I share. I think that's the basis of this law, because they were very concerned that many teenagers would be hesitant to even speak to a therapist, let alone share their inner thoughts and their real feeling. So it was almost a guarantee to the teenager that their information and their thoughts would be protected unless they give permission for it to be shared.
Yeah.
They do have that option.
I understand. Going back to the relationship between therapists and patients, it is a very difficult situation. I've been in that situation myself. And throughout the years, I found that many providers think they are some kind of gods. Patients don't have the right to question their decisions. And I've been there again, as I said, questioning my former psychiatrist about a medication, risperidone, I think, which he gave me for a few years, 2-3 years, until I realized that that medication could kill me
right
long term.
Yes.
And it was for schizophrenia, and I wasn't schizophrenic.
Yes.
And I asked him a couple of times, 2-3 times, and he said, oh no, you'll be fine, you'll be fine. And he just dismissed my concerns.
Yes.
Until I decided to say, you know what? You are not my psychiatrist anymore. You are fired. But people don't feel like they can ask questions. They don't feel like, you know what? I have the right to advocate for myself, because the guy in front of me has a degree in whatever, and he's a god. That's what he is.
Right. You'll get that that attitude by many doctors across medicine, not just in mental health.
Yeah.
I think, based on what you just said, may be fair to say that in mental health, many of the practitioners, I hate to put it this way, but it's the best way I can say it, they take advantage of their patients, because they know their patients are vulnerable. And because they're vulnerable, the doctors can basically say, this is what you need to do. This is the path you should follow. The vulnerable mental health patient may say, fine. So you asked about what to do to advocate for yourself. Well, one thing is, as you just mentioned, you can go find another practitioner. Patients should realize that if things are not, in their opinion, are not working out with their therapist, they have the right to go get a second opinion, the third opinion, in terms of diagnosis, in terms of treatment options. That's one option. The second is, Carlos, I agree with you 100%. Patients should ask questions. And if the physician or the psychologist is not willing to answer the question, then there's a bad relationship between the two people, between the patient and the therapist. Therapist should be open to questions. Mm-hmm. And especially with medicine, in terms of psychiatry, we are smart patients. You know, we deal in our project with consumer health information. Consumer health information is the act of providing information to folks in terms of where they can learn about their conditions, and they can learn about the treatment options and so forth. We are not proponents of Dr. Google. I think that can be very dangerous, especially in mental health. But the internet truly does have many reliable places to go to get information, no cost, that can be discussed intelligently with a therapist. So if a patient goes on and they learn about a certain side effect of a medicine, they have that knowledge. They can certainly come back to the doctor and say, I read a reliable source that says that this medicine may cause this problem. What do we do about it? So I do think that, you know, on the one hand, the internet could be a curse. The other, it's a real blessing because it does educate patients if they're going to the right place. One of the things we pride ourselves on is in our digital library, we have searched for the most reliable sources where you can go and actually link, tap a link and get good information. And we're always collecting new sources. So if anybody in your audience is working with a mental health agency and they specialize in a certain area, they're invited to always send us the link. We will review it. If we feel that it's valuable, we will include it into the library.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just mentioned several options for patients to advocate for themselves when they are seeking mental health counseling. Is there anything else that they can do other than just, you know, this is not a psychiatrist for me, this is not a psychologist for me. I go to Google some other options. Is there anything else that we as patients can do?
I think that patients should feel comfortable in having a dialogue with their therapist. Therapy counseling should not be one way, it should be two way. And if in fact a patient is concerned about the way things are going, you know, one of the things that we're looking at in our new book on mental health is, can a person stay in therapy too long? And I have known several psychologists who have told me off the record that sometimes they hold on to a patient longer than maybe they should, because they feel that the patient has become dependent on them as a crutch. And a good therapist will basically discharge the patient when they feel the patient is able to be discharged, mm-hmm. and not hold on to them, not prolong the situation. Invite them to come back if things worsen. But if the therapist feels that they're on a good path, they have good support, a good therapist will discharge the patient and not prolong the process. So that's another thing that patients can do. They can actually say, you know, we've been going, having weekly sessions for 7 months. I feel much healthier, and I'd like to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
Not insulting the therapist. You're simply saying, I want to take a break and see how I do without coming to therapy every week, and mm-hmm. see where it leads.
So you're saying that therapy is not forever?
Should not be.
Some
people become addicted to therapy. They become addicted to therapy.
You become addicted to talking to someone or having someone to telling you what you need to hear?
Both. Both, that's a good point. Some patients use their therapist as a sounding board, because nobody else will listen to them.
Uh-huh.
So they pay somebody to listen to them, and a good therapist will eventually, if they keep hearing the same thing over and over and over again, and they know the patient is making some progress, they may say, let's take some time off using the tools that we've discussed and see how you fare. Now, again, there's a difference between the talk therapy, I think, and the therapy that comes with medication for a psychiatrist. As you mentioned earlier in the interview, it's really important for the patient who's on medication to be followed by the psychiatrist. We're talking about medicines, and they're very powerful medicines. So it's very important that the physician be monitoring the patient. And one of the things that we probably are aware of, your audience is aware of, is the fact that many psychiatrists only do med checks, don't do a lot of talk therapy. So when people start with a psychiatrist, they may be thinking of the old image of they lay down on a couch and then the psychiatrist is there with a pen. That doesn't always happen. Many psychiatrists are basically trying to diagnose properly, find a medicine that works, tweak the medicine if they have to. And if you want to do talk therapy, they'll send you to a psychologist or to a licensed clinical social worker. But I think in terms of the question that you posed, if in fact a patient feels that they need support and needs to discuss, they can outright ask the psychiatrist, will you engage in talk therapy with me? And if the psychiatrist says, that's not really what I do, then the next question is, well, can you send me to a competent psychologist mm-hmm. who I can do that with? Because both are needed in many mental health situations, talk therapy and the medication.
So in good fairness, at some point, it has to be the therapist who has to say, you are fine. Now I think you can take a break from our sessions and see how you are doing, instead of the therapist himself or herself creating that dependency.
Correct.
Okay. I think that would be a very healthy way to kind of just take a break from having these sessions with a therapist. What else, Bob? What else can you tell us about your experience, expertise?
Well, I would like to, in conclusion, I'd like to sort of open up a discussion about some of the things that the mental health world can do to make it more accessible. One thing is that I feel that there should be far more proactive screenings take place in the workplace, in schools, especially colleges and universities and high schools, where there are trained practitioners who come in at no charge and they do screenings. Recently had a Medicare, I'm on Medicare, and I recently had a Medicare wellness visit. Medicare has instituted that all the primary care physicians are obligated to ask several questions and discuss the mood of the elderly patient, if they feel that they need any kind of medication, if they're feeling depression. So it's actually part of the examination now, screening of an elderly person. I also think that one of the scariest places and the most inhibiting places that a person who's not doing well is sent is a hospital crisis center. What I'd like to see is for the mental health world to create urgent care centers, much like we have urgent care centers for physical health, where there would be trained psychologists and psychiatrists in the urgent care center. And if someone were feeling that they were in crisis, they would be able to go to the urgent care center that would be open 24 hours a day instead of going into an emergency. Now, that may not always be the possibility, but nevertheless, it would open up other options that are less fearful for the patient. I think that we need a lot of education initiatives to educate families, to educate coworkers about spotting problems with their colleagues and their students, spot problems of mental illness, and to be trained to do what to say and what to do initially. Just as we often have to go through CPR training in our workplaces, in our schools. If they could teach us how to initially spot a problem, mood, something that it's not right about our coworker, and then what to say and what to do, how to suggest, how to get them to the right channel, I think that would become very important. We need more public health education. Public health system in this country has to spend more time and energy explaining the ramifications of mental illness and also mental wellness, what we can do to keep ourselves in a better state of frame of mind. And lastly, I think that it's really important that we spend the time to either through our religious organizations, civic organizations, put together outreach centers. Outreach centers that perhaps can be staffed by competent practitioners, that they work pro bono, much as lawyers do sometimes, provide access. The greatest issue I think we have in this country, in the United States, is access to immediate healthcare for mental illness. There are too many people who don't know where to go. They're afraid they don't have the money to spend on a therapist, and they need to find a way to access some kind of understanding. And I think that's why when we began talking about the 12-step program, it's a perfect answer, because someone can simply walk into a room and there are people who are trained lay people who can help them get to a point where they may be suffering, and at least they have the network, supportive network, an encouraging network, who can help them get to the right place that they need to be.
That is depressing. I've seen that, and I thank you for mentioning all those issues that we have to deal with in the U.S. Mental health is a big, big problem in the U.S., I think. We don't have enough resources. I've seen people going into the emergency room because they don't have access to a doctor or to a clinic, and they go into a sudden crisis. They go to the emergency room. They have to pay $2,000 for getting a couple of pills for 2 or 3 days. And I've seen this, the administrators say, you know what, there is nothing we can do. If you have another crisis, you have to come back here. And basically they are telling the patient, you have to spend another $2,000 for being here, so we can give you 2 or 3 more pills. That, and you go to the pharmacy and you spend $5 if you have insurance.
Right.
Of course, I'm talking about emergency room for many people who don't have insurance. And it's a big issue, all that discrimination at work that can create also a lot of mental health issues for minorities. I'm sure you have seen that in students who got to college or high school not having access to a clinic.
Right.
And it is sad. It is sad that we don't have. And now you're mentioning many things that we could do as a country. Anyone out there is going to call you a socialist and say, what's wrong with this guy? Or me. just because we are trying to advocate for better mental health services for everyone. Now, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
Have you ever had any mental health condition yourself?
Yes. I have had depression, and I have coped with OCD.
Mm-hmm.
And very common. I think, Carlos, that well-known fact that COVID did not help things in terms of mental illness. Exasperated mental illness in many people. It was a very depressing time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are a lot of people walking around who might be clinically diagnosed as depressed. They don't even know it. And this is a problem. You know, we lose a lot of people because nobody steers them to the right place to get the help. They feel they're all alone and nobody understands. So it's really important that the word get out that there are places to go and people to see who can help.
I remember reading an article in the New York Times when this whole COVID thing was going on. And this article said that there was going to be a tsunami of mental health cases. And it happened.
Yes.
It was a tsunami afterwards. And we don't have the resources to deal with all these people. And it is really sad.
Yeah. And the fact that we had to stay in, shelter in, be by ourselves, sometimes people who had decent relationships within their home, they had to didn't work out very well because they were together without any places to go, without any resources to, you know, to stay during the day. People got depressed about losing their jobs. People got depressed about not being able to get to a doctor. Heard a lot of people that, you know, if I wasn't feeling well physically, I couldn't just get in my car and go over to the doctor's office because the doctors weren't in their office. So fortunately, as we spoke earlier, telemedicine helped that somewhat. But you're very right. COVID was really exasperated mental illness in this country. And people are still suffering from it.
Yeah. And there is a lot of, unfortunately, there is a lot of stigma. People don't talk about these things openly because they are afraid.
Yeah.
How society is going to put a label on them. On people. And well, I'm really happy that that I got in touch with you, Bob. This is great to find people like you who are doing a great job out there educating patients and everyone about mental health conditions. And I truly appreciate you being here in this podcast.
It was my pleasure, Carlos. It was my pleasure.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. And can you tell us again where people can find you?
Sure. The website is www.thepowerofthepatient.org. So it's thepowerofthepatient.org. And it's a very interesting digital library that we've designed. And there's a lot of things to watch and to listen to and to learn from. So we encourage people from all over the world to access the site and to encourage us to add more based on things that they think they'd like to see. So we're always adding to it. Well, the work that you're doing is very admirable, and I applaud you for taking the subject and addressing it the way that you do, because this is, as you just said, it's something that people feel stigmatized by. They shouldn't. Part of the human experience, I think. People don't realize that, don't accept that. But just as we take physical health seriously, all of us, every man, woman, and child need to take mental health seriously, because they both complement each other. If we're not feeling well mentally, it's going to affect us physically. If we're not feeling well physically, it's going to affect our mental health.
Absolutely. So
they can't be separate. They are one congruent biological problem. I mean, you know, many people feel that they don't realize that mental health or mental illness is a biological problem. And so just as physical illness is a biological problem. So we need to remember that.
Absolutely. In both the mind and the body are connected. And if something is not working, the other part is not working either. Yeah, well, thank you, Bob. And I just want to remind people that they can listen to this podcast on different platforms. And if you can also share this information with everyone, Bob, that would be great.
I will.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.